Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Who does everybody forget, Gary, at Gallipoli? Who does everybody forget? Including us, sometimes.
I forgot.
The French.
The French, were they there?
They were there as much as anybody else was, yeah? And, do you know, in some ways, they were the most efficient military force there. They probably killed more Turks than we did. They do brilliantly. And we've been to that. You've been. You remember the...
I remember the French sector. The Sangers, they're still there.
Yeah.
The horrific, horrific cliff face
that
we had to climb out. I'm not putting anybody off with that, am I? And of course, the French guns that are still there.
Yeah, it's great. So this is it's a tribute to the French and the part they played. And it's a heartfelt and Gary felt.
And Norden felt.
Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Celebrations now, come on. Why am I so happy? Why could I be so happy? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because my book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, is now available to buy. Hooray! Forget all that and pre-ordering. Forget all that. You can actually buy it. You can buy it all over the world through the wonders of the internet. You can pay in a wide range of currencies, and all you have to do is go to our website, which is livinghistorytv.com. livinghistorytv.com. You know it makes sense. Buy today.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans about their experience of war. Join me on a journey through the pages of history. Welcome to Peter Hart's Military History. Hello, and welcome to Peter Hart's Military History Podcast. And I'm here today at the lovely, lovely Bijou home of Gary Bain. Is this your second, third or fourth home, Gary?
Well, actually, it's my only home, Peter, because I'm a poor pensioner.
Oh, you used to be so rich.
And I used to be so handsome too, but these things are fleeting, Peter.
They erode, don't they?
Yes.
You've eroded nearly right away. I've eroded.
You seem to be in a good mood.
I am in a good mood. Although it is a bit hot and sweaty.
You're not going to sing again, though,
no,
are you?
No singing.
I shall not sing.
Oh. Oh, well, what are we doing today, Gary? Give us an inkling of what we're going to babble on about.
Well, it's another Gallipoli podcast, Peter, but this time with a difference. We're talking about the French at Gallipoli.
No, the French weren't at Gallipoli, Gary, were they?
Well, that's a good point, actually. That, you know, many people do not realise that there was a French contingent at Gallipoli, and quite a sizable one, I believe, over 40,000 at one stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, people know about the Anzacs. People know about the, you know, there were some Brits probably up the road at Suvla. Large contingent of French from day one.
And it's not just sort of the Australians and New Zealanders that forget about the French contingent. The British. I remember I write in my book Defeat at Gallipoli and barely mentioned the French. So we also are culpable. And there is one other country.
France.
Does, yeah.
You know, France forgets about the French. Mind you, you would if you were French. You'd want to forget.
they've got a lot of fight. They have done a fair amount of fighting over the years, I think.
Mainly against us.
Now, this is unfair because there is a point of view which I probably hold that given their artillery, they had a proper amount of artillery for their forces there, their 40,000 troops, and they also had ammunition. Which is very different from the British situation, isn't it? Who didn't have enough guns and, why do you need ammunition? If you've got the guns, surely that'll frighten the Turks.
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned on previous podcasts, but this 1915 was at the height of the shell shortage on the Western Front. So that overspilt into Gallipoli as well. And the French, you know, the French have a history of being well prepared and having good logistics. Same in the Crimea. You know, the British were very underprepared and very jealous of the French system of supply. And I've put that in for our good friend, Mr. Thompson, Mr. Rob Thompson. Not Mr. James Thompson, because he won't be listening.
Bastard, James Thompson.
Utter bastard.
So there is an argument for saying that the French were the most militarily effective force at Gallipoli, because they could smash you up quite easily. So how did the French get to be involved? Well, the main reason the French get involved is their rivalry with the British. I think you could put it, they are busy on the Western Front. The most important part of France, the industrial part, was invaded. The Germans were like an arrow pointing at Paris, the capital of France. That was their main concern. But they still kept a close eye on what the British were up to in the Middle East. Do the French naturally trust the British, do you think?
No, and I think it's fair to say that they were keeping an eye for the post-war period. They were worried about British expansion in the Middle Eastern area.
So when Churchill drags, it's essentially Churchill who the cabinet failed to control or stop. So it's a blame that is shared, in my view, across the cabinet. When Churchill drags Britain into the ill-conceived, firstly, the Dardanelles naval operations and then the Gallipoli campaign, the French are particularly concerned with Syria. That is, they regard that as being in their sphere of influence. That is theirs. They have got their beady eyes on it. That is going to be a French colony as far as they're concerned. And so they want to keep in step. Now, this is the French naval minister, Victor Orgagneux. Are you going to do this in a French accent? Yes, you are.
Yeah, I'm going to do this in a French accent.
Here we go, Gary.
Not to take part in the operation would have been, in case it succeeded, to witness the appearance of the English fleet alone before Constantinople. For us French, who are deeply involved in the Orient, it would have been a very painful renunciation of our national pride and perilous for our interests.
Perilous for our interests. Their interests in the Ottoman Empire. That's what they're on about.
Now, rather interestingly, Pete, I had a question I wrote on the notes here. So how did they decide that the lead would be the British in this joint venture? It's so unlike the French.
Well, it is strange because the agreement, the Entente Cordiale, had specifically stated that the French would be in charge of naval forces in the Mediterranean. But they forego that. I think they spot it might be expensive undertaking in ships or whatever. International politics is not my field of interest.
But is it not?
It is interesting that they do stand aside, because it's not a French trait standing aside.
No.
When there's national pride and things.
No, and if it's...
He mentions national pride.
It's about their national interest. So I was intrigued, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of bickering and arguing about it. They just let the British lead.
Now, the first experimental... There is a Mediterranean fleet put together, British and French, mainly pre-dreadnoughts, and they bombard them, first of all, way back in early November 1914. The French take a part in that. And then they start proper operations to try and force the Dardanelles by naval power. This is what Churchill had assured everyone was possible on the 19th of February 1915. This is under the command of Admiral Carden, and the idea was there'd be a series. It's a brilliant plan. First, they deal with the outer forts, then the inner forts, and then the next fort. Now, what happens? Well, it's always the same. The forts seem to be subdued, and then what happens, Gary? What do you think happens to those forts?
Well, they start firing back, I would have thought, after a period.
So they go quiet and then they start again.
And didn't the British, or sorry, the Allies in this case, suggest that it was because the forts were running out of ammunition?
Later on they do. That's after the real attempt to force it. Yeah, they've always got a reason. But in fact, the Turks just don't fire unless there's something dangerous happening. There's no point. The attempt to force the Narrows on the 18th of March 1915, this is probably, in my view, the only serious chance of success. I would say about one in four. Probably less than that. And it's a classic British plan. I love it as a plan because the British seem to be doing dangerous work, but in fact they're not. So they divide the fleet into three lines. The first line, most modern British ships, including the Queen Elizabeth, they go first in line A, Gary. Line A. Guess what line the next line's called?
In French, B.
Line B. Yes, and that would be, so once the British forces had subdued the Turkish forts, or seemed to, they would move in and go closer.
Under the guns by any chance?
Right up to as close as 8,000 yards and finish them off. And then the third line was really older British pre-dreadnoughts that would sort of fill in gaps in the line, that kind of thing. Now, unfortunately for Carden and the Allies and de Roebuck, Carden had gone home by then. Sorry, I do apologise. Carden had been ill and gone home. John de Roebuck was now in charge. Unfortunately for de Roebuck, the mine layer, the Nusrat, had stolen out and laid a line of mines across Erinqui Bay, which was lengthways instead of across the straits. And they put that there because they'd seen the Allied ships, the French and British pre-dreadnoughts, manoeuvring about in Erinqui Bay. Very, very clever. Anyway, the British Line A advances in and they're pestered by howitzers hiding behind their fold in the hills. You've been in some of those hills with me on Killin, up there. They're under fire, but the forts seem to stop firing it. And at just after 12, de Roebuck orders in the French Line B. And a French... Guess what happens as the French Line B moves forward? Can you imagine, Gary, what happens?
Well, I should imagine they come under fire.
Heavy, heavy fire. Because as they get closer and closer, they're, of course, more of a threat to the Turks. So, therefore, the forts really open up. Now, this is able seaman Daniel Sem, who was aboard HMS Prince George. And he was watching as the French ships go forward. Let rip.
Well, before I start, I'd like to actually name the French ships. I think that we should.
Yes.
So Line B consisted of the Suffren, the Bouvet, the Galois, and the Charlemagne.
How did you remember that?
You've put them in the notes.
Oh.
But I think we should mention them by name.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. And yes, that's absolutely spot on.
So able seaman Daniel Sem of HMS Prince George says, I say... Hats off to the Frenchmen. Two of their ships now passed up the lines and took up a position ahead of our ships over on the Asiatic side in a direct line with the Dardanos fort close to Chinak, modern-day Chinakale. If anyone went over into hell, these two French cruisers did. At times, it was impossible to see them for the spray that was thrown up by the shells falling all around them. The fort was firing like hell.
Now, he says cruisers, they're pre-dreadnoughts. Now, the Suffren, that's the flagship of the admiral, the French admiral. It was hit by a heavy shell. Now, who am I going to be, Gary?
You're going to be Rear Admiral Emile Guaprat.
Oh, I was hoping for a bit.
Of the Suffren. And we've recently had a podcast, not podcast, a Zoom meeting with a Rear Admiral, haven't we?
We have, but we're not going to name him, but... Jeremy Larkin, and he was lovely. Now, here we go. This is what Guprati says. In a few minutes, the flagship was hit by a large number of heavy shells, one of which caused major damage. A casemate and a turret were knocked out of action, and all of the crew were killed and incinerated. There was an escape of flame and burning gases into the port magazine. It was flooded to save the ship from the threat of explosion. And then I'll have to go serious. I went straight down. The scene was tragically macabre. the image of desolation, the flames spared nothing. As for our young men, a few minutes ago so alert, so self-confident, all now lying dead on the bare deck. Blackened, burnt skeletons, twisted in all directions. No trace of any clothing, the fire having devoured all. That, I think, the way I read that quote is how sometimes I feel about military history. You can have a laugh and then suddenly all the laughter stops. And I don't know how horrible that was, but that's a nasty description. And that's what naval action's like. But it gets worse, because at 1400, the Bouvet is hit by a heavy shell, by reports, and then in the Allied opinion, it runs onto a mine as well. The Turks don't agree with that, but that's another matter. Now, you're going to be Seaman Saveur Pyro, whatever those names. Gary, tell us what happens to the Bouvet.
The boat immediately listed to starboard. I was completely covered in the coal dust which came from the bunkers. I went to the signal ladder, and with the second mate, we climbed up. From the bridge, I got myself onto the funnel, which was entering the water. Then I climbed onto the hull. I believe that the second mate was trapped and he fell into a hatchway. From the keel, I threw myself into the water. I couldn't rise to the surface because of the tug of the water. I couldn't breathe. Blood was coming out of my mouth and my ears. When I was on the surface again, if I hadn't found this piece of wood, I would have been a goner. I managed to get one of the hammocks and got it between my knees. I saw another chap crying out to me to save him, and I told him to come closer to me so that he could be on one end of the plank and me on the other. But when the English came to fish us out of the water, I saw that both his legs had been cut off.
Not nice, is it? Now, the thing about the Bouvet, this is what happens in naval warfare. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong very quickly. And it's often fatal for almost everyone. The Bouvet took with her in that... It sank in about 2 minutes, Gary. 2.5 minutes. It took with it Captain Rago de la Touche and 638 of his crew. We've seen the memorial to de la Touche on the French... what's that thing called? It's a
memorial.
It's a French memorial, yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, stupid me.
Now,
there were two more British pre-dreadnoughts, the Irresistible Ocean sink, hit by mines and sink, and de Roebuck orders a recall, they give up. Now, at this point, this has been watched by the designated commander of the MEF, Middle Eastern Expeditionary Force, General Sir Ian Hamilton. He'd arrived on the 17th of March, and he was going to command the sort of makeshift army. This was originally intended just to occupy the forts after the fleet had passed through, but now they're going to have to make a landing. The French, they weren't overly keen to get embroiled in a land campaign, but what do you think they thought? Are they still...
Well, they've still got the same concerns and suspicions as the British. They're going to want to keep an eye on what the British are doing.
So they put together another force. They've got the... They must have been going, Jesus wept. But they put together a new force, and it's called the Corps Expedition d'Orient. It's the CEO, we'll probably call it, to save a bit of time. And the first division was the first thing that they sent out. This was gathered up from the depots in France and North Africa. The first is the Metropolitan Brigade, which is the French 175th Regiment. That's a French regiment, if you know what I mean. And the 1st Regiment de Marche d'Afrique, which are African troops recruited in Africa, obviously, sorry. And then the Colonial Brigade, which is the 4th Regiment Mixed Colonial and the 6th Regiment Mixed Colonial. It was a mixture of French, Senegalese, Foreign Legion and Zouave battalions.
Which, if you go to the memorial that you mentioned, the French memorial, you can see that. It's a very diverse group. And you can see that in the memorials and in the markers, the grave markers.
It's cosmopolitan, isn't it? It's built up of a lot of different countries. I think it was a good force, the CEO. It's well-trained troops. They're used to tough soldiering, privations. And they had we've mentioned it before, they had all the guns you'd expect in a division. Not like ours. The Royal Naval Division had no guns at all. The other divisions were short of guns, or guns that were TA, territorial guns, and territorial force guns, and not that good at all. I think I'd almost equate it with the 29th Division as regards military efficiency, because the 29th Division wasn't really a division. It was scraped up, rammed together, and they never operated or trained as a division. The French were more a better efficient. Who was in command, Gary?
Well, it had a good command. It had General Albert Dalmade.
That name seems familiar.
Yeah, he'd been working with the British during the 1914 operations on the Western Front, and I think featured in, a previous podcast that we did, the French in 1914.
He was on the left at Le Cateau, I think.
Yeah.
He was
And a good commander.
Yes, solid. Yeah. Not brilliant, but solid. The British liked him, which is probably important, as he was going to be subordinate to Hamilton. Now, when this French division, they come out via Malta, and there's a wonderful description by Sergeant Darnaud Pomero, who was 3rd 175th. And you're going to read this, and...
The English cheered us. Frenzied hurrahs were exchanged by both sides.
Hurrah!
The Marseillaise was sung by the English. We replied with God Save the King. The two hymns are frenetically applauded by one and all. A trumpet sounds. It's applauded. Then numerous trumpets and bass drums make an incomprehensible noise, which we applauded anyway.
I love that. That's good spirited. But it's nice to see the French and the British getting on. And it's, you know, it's just nice. They push on. They get to Mudros on the 11th of March. That's an island about 60 miles from Gallipoli. And Mudros Bay is a natural harbour. They do have to go to Alex to sort themselves out, but that's where they're based for the next bit. Now, right at the start, it had been decided that they wouldn't land on the Asiatic side of the Straits. Kitchener had told Hamilton it was too big, too big. Asia is too big, too many troops. They were to land on the other side. However, the main landings were going to be made at Hellas Peninsula. Look at your map. We'll put a map up for. And it was decided, dangerous or not, they'd land a French force at Kumkali, which would protect the back from the Turkish batteries that were on the Asiatic side, who could otherwise fire straight into the back of the British at, say, V Beach, W Beach, and as they advanced up in the first day to Achi Baba. So to save them the trouble in that first day during the advance to Achi Baba, the French would be thrown in at Kumkali. And they'd also launch a diversion at Bazika Bay. These two French operations are also, of course, to confuse the Turkish commander, Liman von Saunders. So that's what's happening. Who are facing the French at Kumkali? Well, I think they have the most dangerous task of all. They're facing the Turkish 15th Corps, commanded by General Weber Pasha. And the concept was the usual. Can you describe how the Turks defend things, Gary?
Well, they put up a weak screen to sort of just be an embuggerance, for want of a better word.
It's very technical, but yes.
To obstruct any invaders. And the main force, which was the 3rd and 11th Divisions, would counterattack at night. Very, very typical of the Turkish defence.
So try and, like at Hellas, and hold you up, slow you up, embugger you. What a technical term that is. And then when it's night and the naval guns can't get you, smash you, throw you off.
Yeah.
But here, there's a battalion at Hellas. The whole of Hellas is one battalion. Say three more can come up during the night. At Anzac, there's one company and a division, best part of a division can come up during the night, during the day and the night. But here, the French... they've got three battalions very close, just the other side of the Mendere River. We've seen the Mendere River. We remember going across that Ratley Bridge to the cemetery, and that cemetery will, you know, crops up. And there's three battalions there, and just a couple of miles back, further back from there, were two whole Turkish regiments, i.e. six more battalions. This is a lot. Now, the French were just landing the 6th Colonial Regiment, three battalions of the 1st Division, and they'd land but next to the old demolished fort and Kumkali Village. Kumkali Village is, if you look at a modern map, Kumkali Village is now moved. It's not where the fort was anymore.
No, and we've visited the fort. In fact, Kumkali. Yeah, you can't get into the fort. They won't allow you in.
But we went to the new village because that's where those old guns are that we like.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we did do that.
We like them guns. Now, they have lots of problems with landing. The strong current gets in their way. There's delays, this, that, and the other. And they're meant to be ashore at half, six, seven. They don't get ashore till 10.
I think it's worth saying about the current again. We've said about it previously. When we say strong current, we can't overemphasize that too much. The shipping have difficulty with that current. It's not just a strong current. You're swimming against the tide, for want of a better word.
Literally, yeah. Almost. Yeah, well, except it's not a tide.
They said it's not a tide, it's a current, and you're not swimming. Otherwise, that was perfect.
Thanks, buddy. So they land. Now, the coastal turret, there's really no resistance in the first place. And you might think, oh, well, what's the problem? But they've actually just dropped back the other side of the Mandaro River to have a little look and think about it. They occupy the fort and village, and they're just about getting ready to advance. They're accompanied by a battery of 75mm guns. They're excellent guns, Gary. You love the 75mm guns.
Well, I think they're well respected generally, the 75mm, by anybody who's come into contact with them, with, you know, the possible exception of the people on the receiving end.
Yeah, terrible. Well, fast firing, good shells. About 17:30 to you, 5:30, Gary.
Thanks.
They start to advance on the cemetery where we went, and the lines are still there in the cemetery. It's fascinating. And towards the Arcani Mound, there's a gun battery there. Remember, we went to that one. It's just inland, where there's plastic guns and the real gun. For all these fabulous places to visit. Now, they're getting...
We should say the plastic guns were there because they made a film.
Yeah.
And they left the props there. It's...
That's the Turkish way.
Yes.
Do you tidy up this historic site after you've left? No, you just leave
them. Just leave the guns.
Which, actually, I'm quite pleased because they're nice plastic guns. As they move forward, they begin to meet more and more resistance. And at about 1800, an aerial reconnaissance...
6 o'clock.
An aerial reconnaissance warns them that there's massed columns moving from behind the river and from Yeni Shire. And as a result, the French drop back and prepare the village of Kumkali for defence. So the usual thing, trenches, loopholes, bashed in walls, that kind of thing. Barbed wire put up a little bit, but they don't have much with them. The first counterattacks, when do they come in, Gary?
20:30, which is 8:30.
Should we just leave it to the 24-hour clock and stop buggering ourselves? Yeah. So these three battalions of the Turkish 3rd Division smash home attacks. The attacks are really intense. There's counterattacks. They're fighting tooth and nail. They break into the village. The French have to counterattack. To be honest, without the 75mm guns, they'd never have held it. And actually, the fleet, the supporting French ships and cruisers, pre-dreadnoughts and cruisers, they fire blind into the area in front of where they don't know what they're firing at. They just fire in front of the French positions. However, next morning, they make it. And at this point, some of the Turks begin to surrender. This is probably because they're caught in the open and they know the French naval guns are going to blast them to bits. But then it's a really confusing situation. This is an account by Colonel Reif, of the headquarters, Brigade Colonial. What does Colonel Reif have to say?
The enemy began to wave flags and showed a wish to give themselves up. 80 Turkish soldiers approached unarmed and were conducted inside our lines. Immediately afterwards, many more Turks, several hundred, arrived in succession, but refused to lay down their arms. A parley took place, and Captain Roquel, a very courageous officer, pushed into the middle of the Turks to persuade them to give up their rifles. This officer was surrounded and was not seen again. Others, jostling our men, succeeded in seizing and making off with 2 machine guns. Our men did not dare to open fire for fear of wounding their own comrades.
And in my book, Gallipoli, 1915, which is still available for purchase, I believe, Gary, I know you've got one. I probably had to give it you, but and I know you haven't read it. There's a quote from a great French soldier who's saying, "Well, I was expecting, to be killed in action or possibly wounded. I wasn't expected to be sort of in the middle of a sort of football crowd, and then suddenly, and it's a Velvet Underground song, but suddenly rough hands gripped his package." It's a lovely phrase. And he's suddenly picked up by a lot of Turks and marched off, taking his rifle tape. And what's happening is some are surrendering, but there's a crowd of men and some of them aren't surrendering. And in the confusion, it's not treachery, it's just confusion. This goes on. Later on, another group, about 500 Turks, do surrender. It's the concentrated fire of the 75mm guns and the Navy blasting them from the side. The Navy sail up on either side, basically. However, The British landings aren't going so well, are they, at Helles, VB, HW? It's all failing. They've got nowhere. And so Hamilton wants all the French infantry and artillery to join them at Helles. So this is awful, really. And although the French have stabilised the situation at Kumkale, they then have to evacuate, and which they do on the night of the 26th, and pull back. Now, the casualties... This is serious fighting. How many you've got? I've written down the casualties a little bit vague, but you've got them here.
Yeah. So the fighting that the French have been engaged in thus far resulted in 778 casualties, and the Turks some 1,730, in addition to the loss of more than the 500 prisoners that you've mentioned.
So this.
Now, I would also say, we mentioned it earlier, you know, the French contribution to Gallipoli was over 40,000 men. The memorial, which is in the rather aptly named Morto Bay, contains up to 15,000 dead French, because you've got 3,236 individually marked graves, and being French, you have a number of ossuaries with thousands of unidentified dead. So I want to put that there now as a marker. This is a serious contribution, and they suffered serious loss.
So what we're going to look at now is, how did they suffer all these casualties? And that's what we're going to see. They're in serious fighting when they land. Ashore, they land on the evening of 26th of April, the French 1st Brigade, Metropolitan Brigade landing. Now, here's one of my favourites. And landing at V Beach, they take over V Beach. V Beach becomes the French core base. And amongst them landing is Private Cornelius Jean de Bruyne. Now, the French Foreign
Fantastic
Legion.
Fantastic French name.
Yeah. And it's not real, of course, is it? Because it's French Foreign Legion. And they always change their names because they're all bad types. And what was his real name?
Dick Cooper.
Dick Cooper.
Has a certain ring to it.
It does have a certain name. You're going to read a fantastic quote from I shall always think of you as Dick from now on.
I should always think of you as Cooper. We had no idea where the enemy was. It was pitch dark and raining in torrents. The first company was lost, and Captain Rousseau detailed me with four or five other men to go out in different directions to find them and lead them back to the battalion. I walked for about half an hour through the rain and darkness, stumbling over rocks and dead bodies, and at last, scrambling up a hill, I saw a dim silhouette at the top. I was glad to see any living human being and went right up to him and spoke in French. With a yell, the man dropped his rifle and fled, calling on Allah in Turkish. The best part of it was that I was so startled that I did the same thing. That is, I dropped my rifle and ran.
Hero. Heroes all.
Heroes all.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Fantastic question.
Well, to be fair, I think I'll probably do the same.
Well, it's a natural response.
A real shock to him.
I would imagine. He talks about going up a hill. I would imagine that's the hill from Morto Bay up onto where the memorial is. That's probably where that is. I don't know. Now, the French are given a sign to the right. This is perfect British. The position of honour in any line, I believe, in military terms, is the position on the right. There's another reason why Hamilton put the French on the right. What was that, Gary?
Well, it would have condemned them for the rest of the campaign to the very worst of the fire from the Asiatic batteries. And as the unseen at this point horrors of the Kerch Dere ravine that lay right across their path.
So not they're in a position of honour, but they get that thing.
The honour is to get absolutely mullered for the rest of the campaign.
And all what the British couldn't stand for one day so that the French had to land at Kumkale was then going to be... For 6 months, 10 months, 8 months, the French fate. They'd have those batteries, Kumkale, and all the way along the Asiatic side of the Dardanelles, firing right into their right flank and actually their rear. And there's nothing worse than being fired up from the rear.
And as a mutual friend of ours who shall remain nameless for possible legal reasons, he would describe it as being malleted.
Chris Carling.
Never heard of him.
Next to the French, 29th Division. Now, on the 27th of April, a sort of general advance begins. It's an advance to contact, and they're just basically advancing up the peninsula, moving across to from just above S Beach across to Gully Ravine, moving up. But they're not making much progress, are they? They try again on 28th of April, and this is... an ambitious manoeuvre. They're going to pivot on the right flank, which is where Abide, where the Turkish memorial is now. And they're going to pivot, everyone moving up until they go through Krithia up to a mound called Yezi Tepe. Look at your map, you'll see. You don't really need to know. They were just going to pivot, and the French were meant to stand still. This is the first Battle of Krithia, which would commence at 0800 on the 28th of April. The French, though, were keen to get in on the act. They're still keen. And they, although they're meant to be pivoting on the French, they advance anyway. They start to push along the Kerev Spur. Now, look at your map for this. And they manage an advance about 1,000 yards towards the Kerev's Dere. Now, if you look at your map of Gallipoli, I always say, put your right hand in front of you. That's Helles. The Kerev's Dere is the gap between your thumb and your forefinger. Your forefinger is the Kerev Spur. The gap between them is the Kerev's Dere. That gives you a rough thing. But even simpler, look at a bloody map. Don't be lazy. At the end of the day, some Turkish reserves come up. And there's often a thing because they counterattack and the French fall back. And there's often talk in the British about the silly old French falling back. But actually, the 29th Division run away that day as well. They fall back. And they give up most of the ground. That's come, and the Turks are beginning to build their forces up, aren't they? It's not just one battalion now; it's loads more. How many is it by this time?
Well, by this time it's about 21 battalions, or roughly 17,000 men.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot.
That's equal, or if not more.
Yeah, and that's at Helles, so you know, in a small area too.
So they're going to counterattack. Now, Enver, the Turkish war minister, wants them to attack straight away, but Liman von Saunders is afraid of the naval gunfire with bloody good reason. So on the 1st of May, they attack. Two divisions attack on the right of the line, 2,200, mostly and most against the French. And they hit them. By this time, the colonial brigades come ashore and slotted into the line. But they hadn't dug in properly. So can you imagine it, Gary? Tens of thousands almost of bloody Turks charging out of the night, determined soldiers attacking you at night. You're not properly dug in. You don't really know where you are. What's going to happen? What would you do?
I'd run like hell.
And that's what most of them do. It's not because they're French African infantry. It's not because they're French. It's because it's a natural reaction to what's happening. It's also sensible. If you stay and fight, you'll die. If you fall back, you can counterattack when you know what the situation is. The French are a more mature military country than the British. The British stand and fight to the last man. They don't always, but that's what we like to think we're like. The French are more likely to assess the situation if it's hopeless to fall back and then counterattack.
And let's give the Turkish some credit here. It was a vicious, well-executed attack.
It was. Simple tactics, yep. But at night, the rush of determined troops, it must have been terrifying. Now, so they fall back almost to Morto Bay, up to you know, they almost reach Sedd el Bahr. They're supposed to. I don't believe that, but they're supposed to have got close to it. But then dawn comes. Whoa, what did that mean?
Was she the sort of catering woman?
No, that was a different dawn. That was when you were working at TFL. Tea and biscuits. No, this is a different dawn. This is morning. And what does morning mean for the Turkish troops?
The Royal Navy and the French Navy, of course, would be able to support the French.
And what they do is they blast the Turkish positions as they're trying to consolidate. And what happens? The French counterattack. And they take all the ground they'd lost. So that's good. 3rd of May, Turk launch another attack. And this time we've got a description from 2nd Lieutenant Raymond Wheel of the 39th Artillery Regiment. They've got 155mm guns, big bangy things, I think you'd describe them as, Gary. And they're in the orchards on the outskirts of Sedd el Bahr village. Those orchards are still there. Go on, tell us what it was like.
In a pitch dark, we immediately let go a furious barrage. The fusillade carried on at the same pitch. It was a dreadful, uninterrupted racket. We fired without a break, all out. I had to yell in the middle of the din to make myself heard. All the neighbouring batteries were firing without respite. The Turkish batteries replied. The Asiatic coast behind us sprayed us copiously with shells. That's demonstrating what we were talking about earlier. We were perpetually dazzled by the flashes, so we couldn't see, and we were deafened. Up to 1 a.m, it was a veritable furnace. The gunfire never stopped for a second.
Now, in the end, this attack stopped. They don't break through this time. They break through in places, but they're thrown back. And what's happening here is it's a narrow front. The Allies have started to be in trenches. This is 2 days later. Every day that passes, the trench lines are getting deeper. The British and French trench lines, and of course the Turkish trench lines. It's a bad situation for the Allies. Let's sum it up. Let's go through the situation. Tell me, what state's the 29th Division in?
Well, they're going to be totally exhausted, but also demoralised.
They've been ashore since the 25th of April. They've been fighting. They've been smashed to bits. They've been malleted. They are in a bad state. R&D, how are they? What state are they in? Royal Naval Division.
Well, they've been split up. And you know, let's not forget, they're completely inexperienced. And, you know, you've mentioned it yourself. No artillery.
So they're not that effective. French 1st Division, what state are they in?
Well, they'd suffered severe casualties. They'd already called for desperately needed reinforcements by this stage.
And where were they?
Well, the French 2nd Division wouldn't begin to arrive in Helles, and they were on, all of them, were on the right of the line, the position of honour.
And they'd arrive on the 6th of May. So they're just on their way. So this is not good. But despite it all, We've talked about this. We've done a whole podcast on this. Hamilton feels he has to try before the Turkish dig more trench lines. And so we get the second battle of Krithia for 3 days, starting on the 6th of May. Three times they do it. The French would advance to Kerev's Dere, and then they would pivot on the Kerev's Dere now, not on the French positions at where the Abide now is, the Turkish memorial. They pivot there while the British took Krithia and Yazi Tepe, and then attacked Achi Baba and Tien Skons that's a big problems. Still not enough artillery. No one knew where the Turkish lines were properly. They hadn't found them accurately. And what is this overall?
This is an advance to contact.
Is that good?
Again, no. It's the most difficult of battlefield manoeuvres. We've talked about that before. for the young listeners, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the Battle of Krithia is a bit like, now that's what I call music. It just keeps going until it gets to number 125. It's just repeating and repeating and repeating.
It is. Now, it's because of the second Battle of Krithia is in essence three separate battles. But it's just called the Second Battle of Krithia. Now, how does it go? Well, it all depends on the French advancing. Of course, it depends on the French advancing to the Kerev's Dere. Lieutenant Henri Fuel saw the attack. And this is a terrible account, really. Tell me what Henri Fuel saw.
They advanced as on exercise, our brave troops. No gaps in the ranks, punctuated by flashes of bayonets and blue glint of the rifles reflecting the rays of the midday sun. You would think they were on a training ground. But what is there to say? This wall of steel stops, hurls itself at an obstacle that it can't breach, hesitates, immobile for an instant. Then all the geometric lines fall apart, groups running right, left, thrown into confusion. All the while, Turkish machine guns rattling away, tearing at the air, ceaselessly firing into a wall of palpitating flesh.
Horrible, isn't it? And this is where the casualties... What did you say? 15,000 possibly dead?
15,000 possibly, yeah.
This is how you get to that figure. That wall of palpitating flesh. They're human beings being ripped apart by machine guns.
And let's emphasise that 15,000 dead. That's not casualties, that's dead.
Now, they fail. Three times the 3 days. And by now, it's obvious the French are entering a death trap, isn't it? You've described it perfectly, in a sense, before. In front of them, there's the Kerev's Dere. It's a valley with... You've climbed the walls.
Yeah.
Is that steep, that wall? Do you remember Colonel... what's his name? Duddles.
Yeah.
Colonel Dudley Giles, a distinguished Royal Military policeman. He didn't like it going up there.
Well,
he
had to be fair, dislocated shoulder, I think.
Yeah, and he couldn't fall one way. And the only way he could fall was down the cliff.
And he had nobody to carry his water bottle.
No, nobody.
Poor soul.
I'd like to mention Jeff Harrison, who was particularly good at helping Duddles during the whole of that. And they became great chums as a result of those experiences.
They did.
And I believe they still correspond to this day. It's vertical, isn't it? They say towering cliffs, but there's 30 or 40 feet of cliff,
yeah.
And then very, very steep. And it must be 100 feet down in all. And then a flat valley, and then across in levels. And at the other end, there's a sort of a Y shape with a perfect for defence. So the French have to turn and go up the side of the Kerev's Dere, where there's defence work after defence work by this time. The Haricot, the Quadrilateral, and other nameless ones. But all the time, what's firing into their side and right up their backsides, Gary?
Well, I presume it's the Turkish batteries.
One hopes so.
hope it's not the Royal Navy.
No, well, it could be. The only saving grace is that the French are quite safe, short of shells. That's the only thing. Now, let's talk a bit about the conditions. We've had a whole podcast on the conditions. Flies, district, corpses. But here, I think... Let's look at a particularly French aspect of it. And the joke about it being French is, of course, it's not French. It's the French Foreign Legion. And we're going to go to Dick Cooper again, who is British. So I am now insulting the French. And it's actually a British person who's saying it. Now, what passes for a joke in the French Foreign Legion is it is actually just the same as the British Army humour, isn't it?
Yeah, so we'll give him his nom de plume, Private Cornelius Jean de Bruin, 1st Regiment de Marche.
John the Bear.
John the Bear, yeah. One of the greatest needs was cigarettes. No change there, then. And after a battle, certain of us used to volunteer to creep out and search the dead Turks for tobacco, of which they seemed to have plenty. One night, I found a nice big packet of tobacco in the coat pocket of a dead Turk. On the way back to our lines, I rolled myself a cigarette, but at the first puff, I was nearly sick. God knows how long that Turk had lain out there, but the tobacco had become tainted by his decaying body and was putrid. I rolled about 20 cigarettes and distributed them to the men in my company, who were duly grateful, until they tried to smoke them. Our jokes were a bit on the gruesome side, but then so were the conditions in which we were living and dying.
I just love that. The idea. There's this tobacco soaked in body juices, and he rolls them into tabs, tries one, doesn't like it, so he gives them to his mates. I just love it. That's military humour. The next quote is from Lieutenant Henri Fouille, and it's also about the French Foreign Legion. In this case, this is gruesome beyond belief, Gary. I'm going to be watching how you say the delicious meal that they make. I'm just...
Along the beach were buried the enemy corpses. They had been hurriedly buried just under the sand and pebbles. The crabs swarmed about them in their hundreds. If you knocked over one of the Turkish boots, the hideous living contents came scuttling out. Terrifying. The legionnaires quickly harvest this veritable larder to make delicious bouillabaisse. We certainly didn't eat it, although they said it was delicious.
So the crabs ate the corpses, and French Foreign Legion ate the crabs. I have to congratulate. This, I'd forgotten how sophisticated you are. You're used to fine dining, wining and dining. And French restaurants hold no terrors for you.
I'm known as Gary Culture Bane. Well, amongst other things.
Several of the letters are the same. Now, somehow, Hamilton and Hunter Weston convince themselves. Hunter Weston is commanding the British 8th Corps, which is under. They're the troop, the British troops at Helles. They're going to have another go. By now, it's trench warfare. And our General Albert Damard, he's been recalled to France 15th of May, and his replacement is General Henri Gourard. And he's a good type as well. He gets on well with the British. And what we have now is the third Battle of Krithia, a general attack. And this time, the 1st and 2nd French divisions would attack the Haricot Redoubt and then on to the Quadrilateral and the Ravine du Mort. Does that sound a bit ominous to you in any way?
No, I don't speak French.
Oh, that's all right then. So I'll take you there. I'll show you why. That's where our good friend Roger Chapman lost his camera there, trying to climb out there. It's quite tough in that area. So the French artillery pound the Haricot. They really do. But the Turks respond in kind. And then it's the same story. What did we hear? The rattle of machine guns, the rifle fire tearing into the French poilus, the French Tommies. Poilus is their word. It was a disaster. It's not their fault. It was. Do you think it was possible to? You've been there. You've stood on the Haricot. You've stood on the Quadrilateral, definitely on numerous occasions. Do you think it was possible to attack up that spur with the French, the Turkish firing at you from all bloody sides?
No, frankly, you've got the Keres there on the flank, and I mean, let's not forget now that the Turkish defence system is more mature than it had been in the earlier days. You've got absolutely very little chance of success.
And because the French fail, the Turks then feed down the trenches and take the British of the Royal Naval Division and then the Manchester, and they lose most of the ground they've got. Is that the French's fault? No, it's just war. It's just the French can't be blamed for failing in an impossible task. The French realise there are the losses, 4,500 British casualties, French 2,000 casualties. Turkish figures, well, they're not accurate. I'm not going to read that out. The French know they're in trouble. This is Captain François Charroux, and this is me. And this is what I say. Theoretically, he seems to be British and posh. Theoretically, our situation is untenable. I'd say that if we were on peacetime manoeuvres, the exercise umpires would have adjudicated that we were all dead. That is the logical consequence of our troops living under the crossfire of the Turkish batteries firing from Achibaba to our front and the Asiatic coast to our rear.
It was just like being in Paris.
Oui, mon ami. Would a 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and as you say, 57th Battle of Krithia make any difference? Well, this is what Private Jean Lemoinery thinks. He's 1st 175th Regiment. And he puts it brilliantly, doesn't it?
We were afraid of being attacked, but believe me, we were even more afraid of attacking ourselves. In scarcely 3 months, my regiment has lost 1,700 men, and it isn't over yet.
The British generals often trash, but actually Hunter West and Gourard come up with an alternative, and they're not going to, they can't, they haven't got the troops, they can't make a general advance. They're going to concentrate all their artillery and just take a little bit, bite off a chunk of the Turkish line. This is bite and hold, isn't it, Gary? It's what, you know, so this is quite advanced in my view. Who do you think they gave the honour of trying these new tactics out, just in case something went wrong?
Oh, that would be the French.
Oh, you try it. 21st of June, they launch a concentrated attack, hammering at the Ravine de la Mort. That's an offshoot of Kerouac's Dare. We mentioned that before. And the Haricot and Quadrilateral Redoubts, our old friends. Will it work this time? They dominate the Kerouac Spur. And it's a narrow front of 650 yards, and it contained, it's just awful. Now, what French artillery do they deploy? Well, 7 batteries of 75mm guns. Well, this is out of the world. 2 batteries of 155mm howitzers. Trench mortars, 7 British howitzers loaned to help the attack, to shatter the Turkish defences in that 650 yards. They also, 6 more batteries of 75mm guns would fire into the rest of the Turkish lines they could reach just to make them puzzled and just to embugger them. The French long-range batteries, also the pre-dreadnought Saint-Louis would fire. This is a bit, it worked out, well, you work it out, your maths, I can't do that maths. I believe you could do this along in your...
carried away. It works out a gun or howitzer every 10 yards, Pete.
Amazing. And enough ammunition?
Well, they expend over 30,000 shells, so it certainly suggests enough ammunition.
And it's a crash bombardment too. It's quite modern. It's quite 1918 standing, although not the number of shells. It'd be millions in 1918. They open a bombardment at 5:15, and it lasts just 45 minutes. 6 o'clock, the 176th Regiment charged the redoubts with, alongside them on their right, the 6th Colonial Regiment. They're going for the Ravine de Mort. Now, the Haricot is quickly overrun, and this is Private Jean Lemoinier giving a description of what it's like. This is horrible.
The dead formed the parapets of the trench. At each turn, there were smells that became more and more fetid, carried to us on the gentle breeze. Down the wall of the trench ran a reddish liquid where the maggots swam. If you looked a little harder, you realised that it had been a leg, an arm, a thigh, rotting away covered in green flies, which indiscriminately land on the dead flesh and then you. The more we went forward, the worse the stench became unbearable, and the more the bullets whistled past as the trench petered out.
Heavy casualties, but it was a success. They do take the Haricot. They don't keep the Ravine de Mort. They don't get the Quadrilateral. 2,500 killed and wounded. That's where those people at the memorial come from, Gary. They're building up thousand upon thousand upon thousand. Quadrilateral still in front of them. We've been to the Quadrilateral. It absolutely dominates that area of ground, doesn't it? It is more important than the Haricot, I'm afraid. So the lessons are clear. That's the way forward. 28th of June, the British try on the left and take a large amount of ground on Gully Spur. We don't need... That's a success. And then the French do it on the right. And on the 30th of June, they take the Quadrilateral. It's a great moment. But on the same day, Gourard's wounded by the crossfire coming over from the other side of the straits. That symbolises that although they've taken the Quadrilateral, the French have just dug another one just a bit further up the spur. They've still got the bloody Kerouac's Dare blocking their way. It's sodding hopeful. Who's his replacement for Gourard?
General Maurice Bailot. I think it's worth pointing out that Gourard was badly injured. He lost an arm.
He did. He comes back, though. He's on the Western Front in 1918.
Now, General Maurice Bayard, he's already at Helles. He's an old man. He's 73 years old.
That's older than me.
It's older than you, which is quite difficult. And he's already there. He's commanding the French 2nd Division. So he's up to speed. He understands the state of the campaign.
Now, at this point, Hunter Weston decides, well, clearly piecemeal attacks work. We'll attack in the centre to follow these attacks. The successes on the right, the French, and the left, the British. This is the stupidest plan in the history of the world. It's the Battle of 12th, 13th of July. You could call it the 5th and 6th Battle of Crythia, if you fancied, or whatever you wanted to call it. It's just awful. It's bad everywhere, and it's bad for the French on the right. Bombardment 4:30, French lunge forward 07:35, and amongst them is Sergeant Darnaud Pomereau. He's 175th Regiment.
Without exception, we leapt out at an athletic pace under a thin rain of bullets and a few shrapnel shells. We were advancing towards the second trench objective. The left got there a bit before me because I had a few metres further to go. Got there all the same. Didn't find any Turks. But at the base of the ravine, I saw at least 300 of them swarming about under terrible sustained fire from us. For my part, I fired 8 rounds. I slaughtered 4 Turks, including an officer. I threw a grenade at a group of 4 who were creeping up to within 20 metres.
And the trouble is, that sounds like it's going well, but just a bit later, he's knocked out by a stone from a grenade or something, a shell, or, you know, he's knocked out. And what do you think happens? What happens when you take a position from the Turks?
Well, they're going to counterattack at some point, probably later in the day.
And can you hold it? That's the question. And most of the gains they don't hold. The British in these attacks lose 3,100 casualties. And the French only lose another 840. But something happens now. What happens, Gary?
Well, I think that the French by this stage have really reached the end of their tether in modern parlance.
Would the word mad help in describing?
No, I mean, they've really put themselves through it over the previous weeks. And they've got nothing more to give, frankly.
There's just 2 divisions. Where are they going to get the reinforcements? Or they're grinding down. They've been battered. And there's also something else happening. The French government's beginning to waver, isn't it? Now, this is the focus of an excellent book by George Cassar, which I recommend you to buy. I can't remember what it's called, sadly, but George Cassar. He's written 2, one entirely political and one probably called The French at Gallipoli, which he's got a bit more about it. He goes into great detail. I'm just going to say that the French thought of offering 3 divisions and going in on the Asiatic side. Joffre, the commander-in-chief on the Western Front, he said, mad, va-t'en culé, he said. It's a good job you don't speak French. I hope none of you can speak French either. I need these for my offensives on the Western Front. And the will begins to die away. The Germans trigger the set of situations that leads to Bulgaria coming into the war, attacking Serbia. The French are more interested in Serbia by this time. And the end result is that the Salonika campaign starts and the French 2nd Division leave the peninsula. There's just 1 division left and they move to live and let live, don't they? And you mentioned the symbol for us of this. Tell us again. It was in the last podcast, but tell us about the symbol for us, that the well that symbolises live and let live.
Yeah, thanks for telling me what it was, because I might not have remembered.
I was worried.
Yeah. when we went to the French sector last year, and it's still there, there is a well that was shared by both the French and the Turkish, and they took it in turns to visit it. Which, you know, I think is just remarkable, really.
And it was still there. And that's the great thing about these things. You can go and visit it. It's on the flat plain.
There was a queue of Turkish waiting to use it.
They did shoot at you, though. So the French are now, they're just live and let live. This is what they do on the Western Front. They're a mature country. If there's no point, so they just sit there. They improve their conditions of living and they stay there. And that's the end of it, really, for the French. They don't fight much anymore. We don't fight a lot. The French try and keep out of the diversionary attacks when we're launching the August offensive at Suvla and
Anzac. Sorry, I do apologise. I momentarily forgot where the other 40s were. But they're not going to get involved as much as they can, and they just live and let live, improve and live out. And evacuation becomes the only thing. They evacuate gradually. The French want their artillery out. They want their last division back, the first division out. The North African troops are gradually withdrawn. It's a gradual process throughout through the last couple of months of the campaign.
But they can't withdraw all of their artillery because that's invaluable to the remaining force. And as we well know, there are four French guns that are still there to this day.
Yeah. That they are the big guns. They're fantastic, aren't they, to look at? It would be a sure sign we're going to evacuate. So, and we need them. We just need them. We haven't got enough guns or enough ammunition. So they say, and they finally leave. The Colonial Brigade finally departs on the 1st of January 1916, and the Royal Naval Division shuffles across to take over the Kerevsdere sector. And that's the end of the campaign for the French. They move on, and it's the Gallipoli. They call it the Dardanelles and Salonika Association. It still exists. They move to Salonika, and that becomes their main thing. They fight there. I'm quite interested in the whole thing about why the French pay no interest to Gallipoli. They built a wonderful memorial that stands above Morto Bay. It's dramatic, isn't it?
It is, and you can see it from a great distance on the peninsula. I think, if I may, the French, they don't immediately forget Gallipoli, and I'm going to quote Eleanor van Heiningen, who's a historian.
I used to work with her.
Yeah, she's a historian at the Imperial War Museum, and this is a direct quote. She says, Gallipoli was the subject of frank public debate and resentment in France. The French had clearly been under the command of the British in this disastrous campaign, and so were quick to criticise its organisation, execution and cost. For a time, it was seen as a typical British incompetence and willingness to shed allies' blood.
Well, I'm not sure about the willingness to... Yeah, no, I'd have to agree with all of that, in a sense, because it's all true, isn't it? We give them the worst jobs. We give them the worst job in the Navy, the Bouvet sinking, the Suffren. They're in that second line. We give them the position of honour on the right. We let them test out our tactics. They're given the worst job. They are badly treated by the British, and they suffer dreadfully. The command issue is largely their own fault. I think the majority of the troops were British, so they were going to command that. By the arrangements, the Allied arrangements before the war, the French should have been in charge of the naval forces. However, the Royal Navy doesn't take kindly to being under other people's command. I suspect that's at the root of it. And the French may have had an inkling it was going to be a disaster and perhaps getting their excuses in early. So that's the... The French just aren't that interested. I think French attention is diverted by the Western Front, don't you? I just think that is the main event for them in the First World War. Their country has been invaded. A huge part of it has been taken. The biggest industrial region's been grabbed. They're tens, nearly 100 miles into France. Whoops, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, right? And whilst the losses in Gallipoli are terrible... And they are terrible, 15,000. It pales into insignificance to the pain that they're suffering on the Western Front.
The losses are fascinating because I know Matt McLaughlin. Thank you. Or Nat. Is it Nat or is it Matt? Anyway, Matt did some research, you tried to pin down these figures. Other people, the French figures are strange. You count the numbers in the ossuaries, and there's sort of 12,500 in the ossuaries.
Just in the ossuaries, yeah.
And then there's the cemetery in front of you, and then there's the Bouvet. 600
on the Bouvet.
So I'm not sure where, I can't quite work out the French losses. What I do, I see 12,000 dead a lot, 27,000 casualties. They both seem a bit low. But I can't put my finger on exactly how many. 15,000, I also see 15,000. 12 to 15,000 dead is not an uncommon estimate. What I do know, and this is, it's not a race, that is more than the French, it's more than the New Zealanders and Anzacs, the Anzacs in total, and Australians, put together. Their total losses were more like about 10,000. Now, it's not a race. The suffering of the Anzacs is well documented. But all we're not in any way demeaning that or saying that isn't as painful as it was. What we are saying is, please do remember the French, who suffered as much, in a campaign that was not really their business. It's a politician's campaign, a real politician's campaign, isn't it?
Yeah.
What has it got to do with the French? French politicians, that's what it's got to do. They've got their eye on Syria and keeping their beady eyes on what the British are up to.
On that high note, Peter, I'd like to say thank you and I look forward to the next one.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?